We need to defend science against intrusions to diminish science and the scientific method.
Hello, John. Welcome to How the Light Gets In.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So you're well known for your 2005 paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, one of the most downloaded medical papers of all time. What do you make of that paper 20 years down and its fame?
It was hard to predict that it would become so famous or infamous in a way, given the title and given the content. But I think that I enjoy the fact that lots of very smart people started probing into it and what it was trying to present and demonstrate, and took it much further compared to what I was trying to put together in that paper. So it created interest among very wide scientific communities on issues of reliability, credibility, validity, research methods, research practices, how we can improve them, how we can become more efficient in doing research, and how we can get faster to make discoveries that are both true and eventually change our lives for the better. So maybe that's too far stretched, but hopefully the paper had a constructive input rather than just say that we're doomed.
Yeah, I'm sure. What's a tangible example of this impact, something that's happened?
I think over the last 20 years, we have seen major transformations in many research practices. We have seen improvements in data sharing. When the paper came out, practically less than 1% of scientific papers had their raw data being shared. Now we're at about 20%. We saw major improvements in people thinking more about protocols. We had very few protocols that were available. Now we have a sizable number of studies, especially kind of late translational clinical trials that post our protocols, they're publishing their protocols. We have registration for many types of research. People are telling us what they're planning to do and that this is happening, which is good because we have more transparency. We have seen improvements in disclosures of conflicts and who is funding or supporting research, who is doing what. Improvements in allocating contributions and also a lot of thinking and changes also, hopefully, in the way that we reward science. So a lot of us are struggling to understand how we can reward the best science, not just the most prolific or the one that may be easier to fund, but really science that is rigorous, that is dependable, that we can depend on, that we can really trust. And I think this is a positive evolution.
How can we reward such science?
Well, we have to think about what do we want to get out of science. So there's a component of curiosity and knowledge and gathering information that is reliable. And there's also a component of applied science where we want to see that things work in medicine, that do save lives or improve quality of life in other disciplines, accordingly other types of applications that would be meaningful and helpful. So we need to find ways to make sure that the machinery of science is working in a way that we will get that, and that we will get there faster, in a more reliable way, with fewer errors, with fewer biases, and with a better ability to build on our previous work to go for the next step. So I think if we reward scientists who do good work, who are rigorous in their methods, who are more attentive to important detail, and sometimes the detail is really what matters in many scientific projects. If we think about the big picture, about how do we think about the scientific workforce and where is it heading, how do we incentivize not just getting more papers, but getting better work and getting more reliable work? And also, how do we build an environment that scientists can be better and they can really thrive? You think of young scientists, you know, who have so many obstacles on their way. How do we find ways to remove these obstacles, to make scientific life, let alone life in general, easier for them, more constructive, more meaningful in their effort?
Who is we in this case?
Of course, as scientists, but it goes beyond scientists. I think it goes to the entire community because science does affect outcomes in the entire community. It affects outcomes at a personal level. It affects outcomes at public health level, at all sorts of enterprises that a society may think that may affect its whereabouts, its historical footprint, and where it is heading. So science should be of concern, and the health of science should be of concern for every citizen.
Well, let's take funding, for example, because obviously funding is an issue in terms of sometimes the validity of research. How do we do science without funding that is inherently has a vested interest? And how do you even do your own research into meta research without funding of your own?
So I think that many of my most exciting projects that I enjoyed the most, I did with absolutely no funding. I think it was mostly spending brain cells and neurotransmitters. but I have to acknowledge that that meant that I had some free time to do this. So I could occupy myself with stupid or perhaps a bit less than just stupid questions and try to work on them. At the same time, a lot of research requires funding, and some research may require enormous funding. I think we need to make a strong case that science is the best thing that can happen to humans. If we really want to make progress, we need science on all fronts. So it's a good investment. And economists could come up with very nice numbers, some of them more reliable than others, that for each 1% investment in science, you get 2% or 3% or 4% back in terms of the societal gain in the economy level. But beyond that, we need to convince that funding should go to the most rigorous science and to science that has the best prospects. So the whole effort to try to understand what makes science more rigorous and what makes science have better prospects of delivering either knowledge at the curiosity level or something that is applied has a lot of value, I believe. And also conflicts, of course, many of these will not be possible to get rid of, because they're embedded in the way that our society runs and the market system. But at least we can make them transparent. We can make a case that it should be very visible. It should be very complete in terms of transparency on who is doing what and why. And even for that type of funding that has obvious conflicts of interest, do our best to dissociate the influence of the sponsor from what exactly is going to be the outcome of the research. This is not impossible. And I think that sponsors should accept that, because if they say that I give all these billions of dollars and eventually there will be crazy people like Johnny Anides and some others who will say that, oh, look at that, this is not reliable because the sponsor had control of the research and they pretty much dictated what was to happen, that's not to their benefit. You know, of course they can kill me or these other few crazy people, but that's not going to be an easy solution. So the best solution would be even for them to find ways to be able to tell at the end of the day that, yes, I did invest in that effort, but what I get is reliable, it's trustworthy. You can say that it is useful knowledge, and perhaps I can make money out of it. You know, the sponsor has every right to make money if they have invested in something that is really important and does change our lives for the better.
Do you see one of the roles of science as influencing policy in real time even?
Yes and no. Yes, in terms of if we don't have science influencing policy, what is going to influence policy in a meaningful way? I mean, you know, religion, ideology, political beliefs, party, partisanship, all of that does influence policy, fortunately or unfortunately. Science would be probably the most objective, the most impartial, the most benevolent, or so we want to see, type of influence in dictating or shaping or informing policy. So yes, we want science, because this is knowledge, this is the facts, in a way. Facts is a tortured word. I'm sorry that I used it, because it has been misused so extensively. But I think we understand what I'm trying to say. So we want science. At the same time, we want science that is impartial, science that is independent, science that is not conflicted, science that is not affected by lobbying. We need to have a very clear line that separates advocacy, activism, lobbying, sponsoring, indirect effects of all sorts from science itself. I have tremendous respect for activists who want to improve our planet, our life, our future. They're hopefully well-intentioned. Not all of them, but many are. Advocates, even when they merge with science, of course, they also have some role. But it's important to keep science distinct so that one can say, this is the science, this is the evidence, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. And now here comes the advocacy, the activism, the agenda, in a sense. These have to be differentiated. And I worry that increasingly these are becoming more difficult to differentiate. So science is becoming weaponized, many times for seemingly good reasons, but being weaponized even for good reasons is not a good idea, I believe.
Well, an interesting recent example would be the pandemic, where there was an issue in real time that required scientific input to make political decisions. What do you make of that situation?
It was complete chaos. And I think all of us leave that chaos with very adverse consequences for everyone, both at the level of eventually not getting the best possible outcomes in terms of saving lives, and also in terms of the consequences of both the pandemic and the measures that we took on long-term outcomes, including mental health, what happened to our children, education, and so many, many other frontiers of disrupting health systems and healthcare. So I think part of the problem was that difficulty to separate advocacy, activism, political ideology, lobbying, people who had an agenda from science. We produced tons of science. We published close to 1 million papers on COVID-19. More than 2 million scientists published something in the peer-reviewed literature on COVID-19. Unfortunately, most of that was pretty low quality, even lower quality on average compared to the rather low quality of the rest of the scientific literature. And a lot of that was driven by not the best methods or the most objective approaches. It was more fitting into narratives and expectations of what should be disseminated. At the same time, we had a huge kind of counterforce of conspiracy theories, of reactions that were completely irrational, and the mix was explosive. You know, I think we lost a lot of trust in science, unfortunately, because of that tension and that war level type of engagement with what science is and how it has an interface with policy.
So how should science react in an emergency?
I think that we should continue with our principles, which are based on the scientific method. So the principles hold both in times of peace and in times of emergency. So organized, healthy skepticism, the need to pursue rigorous replication, the need to be open and transparent and share. Universalism, trying to engage everyone who has, of course, some knowledge on how to contribute, interdisciplinarity, communication in an unbiased way. I think all of that is desirable in regular times, and I think it's even more desirable in a time of crisis. And I think that this is probably what goes wrong in a time of crisis. People think that, well, now I can start cutting corners. I don't need organized, healthy skepticism. I just need consensus. Or I don't need replication. There's no time for replication. Well, then we're many, many years into a crisis and we still haven't replicated some of our very fundamental beliefs about what to do. Or we don't need transparency. And then we realize that a lot of the data may be flawed or completely non-trustworthy, or now we have AI being able to produce millions of papers overnight, literally. So we need to stick to our guns. We need to take what our values are and say, well, now we need them even more, not less. We need them even more. We need to defend science against intrusions to diminish science and the scientific method.
What do you think is the biggest threat that AI, as you mentioned, presents to this scientific rigorous paradigm that you...
I'm horrible at making predictions about the future. AI is yet another tool. I don't see it as a completely different type of challenge compared to other tools that we had to insert to our armamentarium. It has lots of capabilities, so I think we need to explore them and see what they can do. We need to watch out very carefully at what it produces. It has the ability to produce massively papers, data, fake papers, reasonable data and reasonable papers at the same time. So we need to be very careful at what it does and have some sort of an observatory that is ongoing. I would not go into thinking that humans are going to be extinct because of AI. I would not think that it's the end of the world, but it's a tool that we need to monitor.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you so much for the interview.